Hello everyone, welcome back to another episode on Tuk Tok Podcast. I am Dr. Gil. Thank you so much for joining to the Tuk Tok Podcast live interview at the London School of Economics with Professor Carlo. Tuk Tok Podcast is a discussion of culture, history, politics, and current affairs of Tibet and China in international politics. It's my honor to invite Professor Carlo. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at University of Colorado, USA, and a scholar of contemporary Tibet and Himalayas, author of Arrested History, Tibet, the CIA, and the Memories of Forgotten Wars of the Tibet, and Tibet-related articles, essays, books, and she is also working on like upcoming many books related to Tibet and other scholarships. Welcome to Tuk Tok Podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with like how you get like interest in Tibet and when you start studying like the more focus on Tibetan studies.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sure. This is actually one of the number one questions I'm asked. I have an answer for it, and it's somewhat long because I'm going to give you the whole story. So when I was a university student, I wanted to study abroad, which is something very common in the United States, and students go and do one semester or 1 year in another country. And many students from my university came here to London or went to Paris, but I didn't want to do that. I wanted to go someplace else. And I found a catalog for a school that had programs around the world, not just in Europe, but in other places. And I opened up the catalog to the page on Nepal. And the first sentence said, Nepal is a country of superlatives. And it said, like, from sea level to the top of Mount Everest, you know, over 40 languages in one country, you know, some multiple religions, like different climate, everything. And I read it and thought, this is where, like, I've always wanted to go here, but I didn't know. Right, until I read that. And I called my parents and I said, I'd like to study abroad in Nepal. And they said, where is that? And I said, I don't know, but I want to go there. And they let me go. And at the time, I knew nothing. The Himalayas, Nepal, Tibet, nothing. When I got to Nepal, so I was 20 years old when I went. This was my first time leaving the United States. The teachers we had took us up to very close to the border of Tibet to south part of Mustang. So we were in a village called Marpa, which is right near Jomsom, Mutanath, Kagbeni, that area. And in the village where we stayed, there was a Tibetan refugee camp just a 10-minute walk south of the village called Sirok. And this was on a trekking route. It's the Annapurnas. And a trekking route is a place where, you know, people are trekking going around this massive mountain range and spending just one night in each village. But we were a group of American students, and we stayed for 2 weeks. So we became a tourist attraction, right? Because it was so unusual for these foreigners to be staying and not continuing on the next day. And we were learning to speak Nepali. So every day we could speak more and more Nepali, right, to talk with the local people. And men and women from the Sero Tibetan camp would come every day to see what we were up to talk with us, you know, to just sit down, have tea, have biscuits. And what they told me changed my life. All right, so this was at a time in the world when the story of Tibet, no one knew what it was. You know, like, I was the sort of college student, university student, like, I would have known. So, like, now when I step into the classroom, I can presume that my American university students, they know that something happened in Tibet, that there's some sort of issue associated with Tibet. They might not know all the details about it, but they know there's something. When I was in college, when I was in university, that wasn't the case. Like, the Free Tibet movement hadn't emerged yet as an international or global movement. So I knew nothing at all. And what they told me, like I said, changed my life. So this was 1989. It was 30 years after Tibetans had escaped in 1959. Right, so exactly 30 years. And they told me they had lost their country. They had fled on foot, right, over the Himalayas, in, you know, the world's tallest mountain range, right, into India and Nepal, and had left behind their parents, right, their grandparents, right, aunties, uncles, friends, you know, their animals. and that for a 30-year period, they had no way of being in touch with these people. At the time, I mean, there were no cell phones, there were no mobile phones, but there was also no way, you couldn't make a phone call on a landline. That didn't exist. You also couldn't send a letter. So there was no way to just write a letter by hand and mail it. People were also not coming back and forth, so you couldn't even get oral news, right? Say someone from your village escaped and could share with you that your family was okay. So they literally knew nothing. They didn't know if their families, friends, you know, were alive, or what their story was, or what had happened to them in 30 years. And I sat there and thought, oh my goodness, I didn't know that was possible. Right, that you could lose your country, that you would be separated from your family and live for 30 years not knowing if they were still alive. And I thought, you know, back in Kathmandu, there was a plane ticket with my name on it. And at the time, there was one place in all of Kathmandu where you could make an international phone call, but I could go there and I could pay, you know, so many rupees, and I could call home if I wanted to. Right? And the fact that there were people who couldn't do that made a huge impression on me. So I wanted to know why. Right? What happened? How did the Tibetans lose their country? And why did I not know this? Why did the world not know this? And I wanted to tell people about it. And so I went back to my university in the United States, and every single paper I wrote for the rest of my college career was about Tibet. My professors must have been very, like, I don't know, annoyed or amused by me. After I graduated from university, I got a scholarship to go and do independent research for 1 year in Nepal, but also to go to Tibet. And so I was learning to speak Tibetan. After that, I volunteered in Washington, D.C. with ICT, the International Campaign for Tibet, which was at that time, this was before SFT, Students for Free Tibet, existed in the world. It hadn't been created yet. So in the U.S., ICT was the Center for Activism. And so I went and became a kind of a young activist scholar and worked with a wonderful man, Gyari Rinpoche, so who some people listening might know, who at the time was the Dalai Lama's special envoy. And he was the person who was leading all of the Tibetan delegations to China for negotiations with the PRC. And he took me under his wing. So he was a politician who understood the importance of partnering with scholars. And so right from the very beginning of my career, like, my first teachers were those Tibetans in that camp. Right, and then Gyari Rinpoche in D.C. Like, my anthropology professors were in there too, and very important. But my very first teachers, and not just for language, right, for understanding history and politics as well as culture, right, was a Tibetan community.
So today we are going to discuss more on the like Professor Carlos' book, The LSU History. This book is more focused on the Chushigong, right? The four rivers and five rangers, six rangers, right? So before we go into the deep of the argument and discussions, can you give like the background, like the historical events and the significance of that era?
Okay. Sure. So this book is very specifically about the eastern province of Tibet, which is called Kham. And so one of the things that Gyari Rinpoche said to me when I went to graduate school is, Carol, we need someone to write a history of Tibet from Kham. So at the time, all histories of Tibet were focused on the capital, on Lhasa. Right, in the same way that histories of, you know, England are centered on London, histories of the United States are centered on, you know, Washington, D.C. Right, but at what happens when you go out to the margins, right, and go out to the frontiers, to the regions, right, and leave the center? What story of a country do you tell from a different location? And because Kham is the easternmost province, it's the border with China. So the people of Kham had the longest experience dealing with China. So this is what I wanted to know, right? So even coming to write this book, to work with Chushigandru, had to first start with just going to people from Kham, called Kampas, right? And to ask them, right, what does it mean to be Kampa? What does it mean to position yourself in that way, be positioned vis-a-vis the state? And one of the things they told me, two things they told me right from the very beginning, is that the Kampas were the fighters, that they were the ones who historically had to defend Tibet against China, in some ways because of their location, but in another ways because that was who they are, right? And that's also a stereotype of people from this area, that they're the fighters, right, of Tibet. But also, Something else they said to me, specifically a man named Nyarong Atin, changed also what I was doing. So I had started graduate school, a PhD in anthropology. And after my first year, I went to Kathmandu and was doing preliminary research. And he said to me, if you want to ask questions about culture, identity, and politics, we have to talk about history. It's like, you have to pay attention to history. So I went back to the University of Michigan where I was a student, and that's when I enrolled. I switched from just doing a PhD in anthropology to a PhD in anthropology and history so that I would get theoretical, methodological, right, disciplinary training in both of the both of those fields. So as I started doing my research, one of the things that just immediately caught my attention was the Tibetan Army Chushigandru. So as Drukpa just said, that name means four rivers, six ranges. So it's an ancient name for Kham, for this region, that references the four rivers that kind of cut through, going north to south, and the six mountain ranges. And this was a name that was actually given to the army by Ling Rinpoche, by one of the Dalai Lama's tutors, who himself was Kampa, but as an auspicious name for the army to have. And I was interested in this in many ways. One, because it was a Kampa history, so this was doing that decentering work that I had been asked to do, right, by Gary Rinpoche. But also, it was the 90s. And, for the scholars listening to this, if we look back, you know, if you look at each decade in the discipline of anthropology or the discipline of history, think, okay, what was going on at that time, right? What were the conversations? What were we talking about? And the 90s was all about, in some ways, subaltern studies, post-structuralism. So it was about looking at non-elite histories. It was about decentering, right? The privilege, the national, the decentering Lhasa, for example. And it was about looking at stories that hadn't yet been told. This story, I would argue, and this is the title, right, was not told, was not known, but it also had a connection to my country, right, because of the CIA. And the only way the story had been told was as if it was a CIA story, which is an incorrect, a very partial way to tell this story, because the story of Chushigandru is really a Tibetan story, right, that predates and pre-exists the CIA interest in or involvement with the army.
Yeah, it's very interesting. The Chushigandru, they have like the structure, organization, there's a declaration and all these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you give like more background about like what is exactly the Chushigandru?
Okay. All right, so a little more quick history. Right? 1947 is when Indians, can I say this in London, kick the British out, right? So quit India, right? So India reverts to an independent country, right? Is no longer a colony of British Empire. 2 years later in China is when Mao Zedong's communist PLA, People's Liberation Army, defeats Chiang Kai-shek's Republican Army. Right, so in a two-year span, we have an independent India, and all of a sudden we have a communist China. One of the very first things that Mao says he wants to do is liberate Tibet. And he says he wants to liberate Tibet from feudalism and also from imperialists. There were two British men in Tibet at the time, right? So it wasn't really as if Tibet was some sort of imperialist hotbed. And they were both radio operators. So that was a bit of a farce. However, he was true to his word. Because he invaded Tibet, and he did it right around the same time that the Korean War started. So it was very much a bait and switch sort of thing, where the world's attention was focused on Korea. Mao moved into Tibet. So first went into Kham, so this eastern area, also to Amdo, the northeastern province of Tibet. By 1950, they had crossed the Drichu, which is the main river, one of the main rivers of Tibet. And then eventually made their way to Lhasa, to the capital in central Tibet. By 1951, the Chinese had forced the Tibetans, to sign what's called the 17-point agreement. Right, so the 17-point agreement in 1951 basically ends up putting Tibetan government, the Tibetan people, somewhat under China, in a framework that's said to be cooperative and where there's some autonomy. The Tibetan government said that it had been signed under duress, right? So a forced signature and a stamp that actually had been crafted in the moment that wasn't an authentic stamp. And so they rejected this after initially trying to make things work. All right. It's a long history, right? And the same thing, like initially when the PLA, the actual soldiers, went to the different villages, they were very kind. They had instructions to be nice to the Tibetans. They would come in with bags of silver coins. Right, and they would hand out these silver coins. Actually, I talk about this in the book. Right, like there's a saying that translates in English: the Chinese are like kind parents. The silver dollars rain down on us. Right, because they were just going around basically like buying people by giving them money. Then everything changed, and it started changing around 1956. And then at this time, this is when people use the phrase "turned upside down." That all of a sudden society was turned upside down. So the heads of society, whether they were monks, whether they were chieftains, whether they were kings or queens, and the different, basically, counties or payu of Kham were organized differently. Some had chieftains as their heads, some had monastic religious leaders, and some were monarchies. Right? So it was a really different patchwork of political and social organization. Those historic, hereditary, and traditional leaders were made to be castigated. Ordinary people, beggars, were lifted up and became the leaders. You know, the Chinese instituted them as the leaders. Really, like literally turned upside down. At the same time, then abuses started. People were forced to verbally abuse and to physically abuse in public their leaders through tamzing practices. The cover of this book shows some of this period. It shows planes flying overhead monasteries, bombing the monasteries, which is actually how the book starts, with the bombing of the monasteries. It shows Chinese soldiers pulling down statues of the Buddha. Right here, an image of scripture burning. A Chinese soldier here chasing at gunpoint a Tibetan monk. And this actually, the cover image, this was drawn by one of the Tibetan soldiers. Right, so in the army. So as this happened, right, as the pillars of society in terms of both institutions and also the leaders were attacked, the people decided to start fighting back, right? Both men and women, just ordinary people, farmers, nomads, carpenters, teachers, you know, pastoralists, whoever, it didn't matter who you were, started to fight back, and you just fought back from where you were. First your neighborhood, right, your village, then joining with the other villages in your district. Then eventually, as things got worse, as more Chinese soldiers were coming, the different districts, or the different payu, right, in Tibetan, started coordinating, right? So they would send from Litang, send a letter to Dege, to Nyanrong, to Darsendo, to Chating, you know, on the fifth day of the seventh month. Let's all attack on this day. So then they started coordinated efforts to fight. And then this continued for a while, loosely under the name of Tenzin Danglangmar, which is basically just like army to defend Buddhism, right? To defend the Dharma. I'm making this very quick, seems long, this is like very quick version of the history. As things continued to deteriorate, because the Tibetans had very old rifles, basically, that they had gotten from British India, and they had knives. The Chinese had airplanes, right? They had machine guns. They had modern weapons, and the Tibetans had very antiquated ones. There was also a vast discrepancy in the scale of the armies. You know, Tibetans had men in the, women in the thousands. China had them in the millions, like, and they just kept coming. So the Tibetans eventually had to escape, go west to Lhasa. And it was in Lhasa that they then decided to create a formal army. Right? And to create not just a loose informal army, but to come together as a formal army. That's when they petitioned one of the Dalai Lama's tutors for a name. They received the name Chushigandru. They collected money from all of the members of the army, as well as from the main traders of Amdov Kham, all of the wealthy families, a number of central Tibetan families as well. And they created a golden throne. In gem-encrusted throne for the Dalai Lama. They offered this throne to him, along with a long life ceremony for His Holiness, as kind of the consecration of the army. Right. So it was June 16th, 1958, that the army was formally created. And at that moment, because it was an army dedicated to the Dalai Lama, women stopped fighting in it. It was considered culturally inappropriate for reasons of pollution for women to be in the army at that point. So their role then shifted. And at that time, it became an army of just men, right, versus the entire community fighting. All right, that was a lot. I mean, it continues, but there's how things got started.
And when we talk about the Cheshire-Kantuk, the most successful part of the Cheshire-Kantuk is the Cheshire-Kantuk armies, they helped to escape the Dalai Lama, right? And they started. Can you talk about the initial relationship between the Tibetan government and the Cheshire-Kantuk in the initial stage?
Okay. So as you can imagine, the Chinese were not very happy with Cheshire-Kantuk, right? That it came into being, that it existed at all, because there was a Tibetan army. So there was an official Tibetan government army that was quite small, and it was not fighting back against the Chinese. And the two armies did not formally join. A couple men defected from the Tibetan army to join with Cheshire-Kantuk. But the Tibetan government was in a very difficult place, right? This was at a time in the 1950s where they were still... There was still hope. They were still hoping that in some ways that the autonomy that the Chinese Communist Party had promised them would manifest, would become true. And they were also trying to protect everything in Lhasa. So they were trying to negotiate, cooperate, to see if there was a path forward at the same time that they were entirely suspicious and not trusting of the Chinese. And the Tibetan aristocrats who controlled the government were also in that same position. Many of them were trying to defend their position, their wealth, their families, right, their name, by cooperating in some way with the Chinese. So the relationship with the Tibetan government had to be one that was very secret. Right, it was the sort of thing where, in a back room in a hallway, the equivalent of the prime minister would say to the Cheshire-Kantuk general, to Andrew Gompotashi, the leader of Cheshire-Kantuk, if you go to the Tibetan government armory, right, in this town, to the zone, here's the password, basically, to say to the head abbot, so that you can go in and collect all of the arms and the ammunition that's stored in the fort. Right. We can't officially let you do it, but wink, wink, right? Here's how to get in there and get those arms so that the army can have them, right? So all of that had to be done, not just under the radar, but entirely secretly. And that remains a point of tension also, right? That the Tibetan government couldn't publicly support Cheshire-Kantuk. Cheshire-Kantuk, however, publicly supported the government. And so we just had March 10th, right, the commemoration of Tibetan Uprising Day, which is a commemoration, of the Tibetan public civilian defense of the Dalai Lama in fear of a kidnapping attempt, right, by the Chinese. So His Holiness dresses as a civilian, right, manages to escape Lhasa on a horse, and it's the Cheshire-Kantuk soldiers, right, who escort him safely from Lhasa into India. Two of the soldiers on that were trained telegraph operators who had been trained by the CIA, and so they were radioing, out His Holiness's status and position, right, to CIA operatives, actually back in Virginia, who were receiving this, just outside of Washington, D.C., receiving the news. So the world did not know, right? It wasn't announced to the world that the Dalai Lama was trying to escape, right? It was kept entirely secret. China didn't, probably both knew and didn't know what was going on. We don't fully know that entirely. But it was Cheshire-Kantuk, those two telegraph operators, and then a battalion of bodyguards, right, who made it possible for him to escape. So the Tibetan scholar and writer Jamyang Norbu has stated that if it wasn't for Cheshire-Kantuk, right, the Tibetan exile community would not exist, right? The exile government wouldn't have been able to come into formation because His Holiness would have got stuck, right, in Tibet and probably kidnapped.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your book, the title is Arrested History, right? Mm-hmm. The Tibet CIA and the Memories of Forgotten Wars. History as an anthropologist. Why you feel that this is very significant, and why and how the Cheshire-Kantuk's history arrested?
Mm-hmm. It took me a long time to figure out what to call this practice. So a lot of the people with whom I spoke described this practice of historical production, but it didn't have a name. And so what I mean by historical production, I'm taking a term from Michel Rouve Trio there, just the Haitian anthropologist, is the question of what becomes history, right? So what happenings, what events are historicized, and what aren't given that category, right? What aren't granted the status of history, and what happens, right, to those experiences you have, the knowledge you have, the memories you have. So for example, for those bodyguards who escorted the Dalai Lama safely to India, that was the number one experience of their life. The defining moment of their entire life and service, you know, service to the Dalai Lama, you know, given the depth of the faith you have in him, the devotion you have to him, you've taken him as your teacher, you know, is something that's precious, right? So what do you do when this most precious life's experience is not known, is not valued, doesn't become history, right, by your community? How it was explained to me is that everyone understood that you couldn't talk about the history, right? We're not allowed to talk about it. The time will come when we can talk about it, and that this pivoted or it relied, you know, on the Dalai Lama, that it was potentially dangerous to tell this history now. It might harm His Holiness. We need to wait. We need to look to him for signs, you know, of what can happen, like when maybe we'll be able to start telling this history. And the more and more I had conversations with these people, I understood that it wasn't that it was going to be secret forever, but that a time would come when the history, when you could tell this history. So it was like it was being postponed, it was being held. And finally I came on the idea of a rest, because that actually felt, it really fit in many ways with the way that the term works in English, given that there was no Tibetan term. And that's very cultural, right? Think of all the cultural things you have that you do, that you believe in, that don't have a name, right? So there are lots of cultural practices we have that don't have names. And if someone asks you why you do it, you just say, I don't know, right? That's just the way we do it, right? So it's one of these sorts of things. So for when a history to be arrested means that it is, I was going to say it's insane. It's keeping maybe safe. It may be a safe location, but the period of arrest is often one of being battered and of actually not necessarily being well kept, right? If you think of a jail cell, if you think of a prison cell. But the idea is that a time will come, right, when the history can be released, and that then you will be able to tell it. For me, this also fit the Tibetan idea of the ter tradition, or terma. So terma are treasures that are buried, and they can be physical objects, you know, like a material object, like a water bottle, or a book that is literally buried in the land by someone who is a trained terturn, a treasure revealer, to be found decades, centuries in the future. Or it can be something that's non-tangible, an idea that's buried somewhere in the mind of a future being that will be found in lifetimes in the future. So something also about the idea of terror seemed very resonant with this. And terror, of course, are dotted throughout the landscape of Kham, right? So also there was a connection to Eastern Tibet. Why arrested, though? You know, why was this so... Before all of that, though, what was evident to me the minute I started doing this research is that people didn't know this history. Most Tibetans did not know it, and I started doing this research in the early to mid-90s. It was not known. So people from other provinces just didn't know what had happened, but even people from Kham, from the province that had most of the soldiers, Omdo also had many soldiers who were in Trishigundra. They didn't know either. Sometimes I would sit down with someone, you know, to interview them. You know, and an old man at this point, someone in their 60s, someone in their 70s, and family members would gather around and say, we've never heard these stories. And I would think, how can this be possible? We're like, how can you not know the story of the fight for your country, right? Which is often the first story that is told. So why is this story not told? This is the other question I get asked a lot. Like, why is the history arrested? You know, what's the reason? So one, the Tibetans didn't win. I would say that's a clear answer. And yet, if you think of all the other histories, you know there's lots of stories of the valiant effort that was made, even though, right, we failed on the battlefield. So that doesn't fully explain it. Two, it involved the CIA, so it was secret, right? Everything involving the CIA, you know, is secret. So there were many things they were not allowed to talk about by virtue of that relationship, but that's only a small part. Three, when you have a politics of nonviolence, it's difficult to narrate a history of war, right? War is not nonviolent. Right, so that right there is a very big tension, and that's very uncomfortable. That's difficult to talk about, right? And when you stand before the world and say, ours is a nonviolent struggle, how do you then add in, but we fought, right? And not just metaphorically, not just at the UN. We fought on the battlefield, right? That's a difficult story to tell. So Buddhism does make an allowance, right, for fighting when the Dharma is under threat, right? So there are, you know, various, not fully loopholes, but ways to defend yourself that are encoded, right, within scripture, within practice. But what I can tell you is that all of the soldiers I knew, you know, who were veterans when I knew them, spent the rest of their life atoning for any of the violences they had committed on the battlefield. Men who had been laymen before, many of them became monks, right, to try and purify the violences that they had committed. Men who had been monks before who had unrobed or disrobed to serve in the army, you're not allowed to put those robes back on once you've taken them off, because now you've broken your vows. But they were some of the most devout religious, spiritual, pious people I've ever known in my entire life. Not some of them. They were the most devout people. All right. So there's three reasons, but there's a fourth, right? And the fourth, I think, is the one why this history still remains not fully released. And it's about internal politics. It's about the politics of community, right? What does it mean to be a community? So those regions of Tibet, we say, right, like Pur Choka Sunre, right? Tibet is three regions, three main regions. And in some ways, those are fighting words. They're not just a factual statement, right? So where you are from means a lot, right? It's part of your identity. It's part of your history. It's where your family's from. It might be how you tie your belt. It might be the specific dialect you speak or how you fold your momos or make your bread, right? Or eat your sampa. It's who your deities are and who your rinpoches were. It's a deep core part of your being. Coming into exile, and even in the moment of fighting, that had to be about unification, about coming together all as Tibetans, rather than saying, well, I'm a Kampa and you're an Amdawa and you're, I don't know, from Shigatse or you're Ngari. And the way that this unfolded in the Tibetan community and continues to unfold was as a tension that's been really painful, which is that to be unified has meant there hasn't been space to also have a regional identity that's meaningful to you, that's not threatening. And the community to this day, in many places, not in all, has a hard time allowing it to be and, right? Tibetan and Kampa, versus having to choose one or the other as your primary. And that is really at the heart, I think, of why the history is arrested, because it puts, it brings to the surface something that feels dangerous and that divides the community rather than brings it together.
It's 1970s, right? Like mm-hmm. Nixon went to China, Kissinger went to China, and then after that, like, there's like lots of changes within the politics, and also there's lots of changes in the like Chushikantu, mm-hmm. and also at the same time the Nepalese government also like the change into. Talk more about these things, like the politics of this, like US politics, CIA and Nepalese government, all these things, how these things happen.
So there are three main governments involved. in negotiating both with Chushigandru and with the Tibetan government. And I kind of want to make the point that they were operating not as equals, but as two units working together. And so Andrew Gompa Tashi, again, considered the founder of the Chushigandru army. From the Tibetan government side, we had Jalu Tundu, who is one of the Dalai Lama's brothers. And so he was sort of the official, unofficial emissary from the Tibetan government to the U.S. government. Also himself a controversial figure. I think it's important to say that out loud. So the other governments were India, Nepal, right, and the United States. Okay, so the United States, because of their anti-communist, right, politics, and again, this is the Cold War, right? So this is during the Cold War, like the height of the Cold War, of course, wants to support Chushigandru because they're fighting against the communists. Unlike most CIA operations, where the CIA goes in and would create a body to agitate against the ruling power, Chushigandru created themselves, right? Like this was a homegrown citizens initiative. This was a citizens army. And so for the CIA officers who worked on this Tibetan mission, it was unlike any other they ever participated in the rest of their careers. Again and again, CIA officers told me that. Like, the Tibet operation was special. It was different, right? They had, like, this mutual respect for each other that just was mostly unprecedented in their other relations. India and Nepal basically were in some ways in a position, especially Nepal, to have to do what the U.S. asked. So what the CIA did is first they trained those initial soldiers, the bodyguards and the telegraph operators in on the island of Saipan, which was a bit of a U.S. semi-colony at the time. So they were trained there. They quickly realized that a tropical island was not an appropriate place to train Tibetans from, like, you know, the high plateau. Then they started training Tibetans in Virginia, which is also a sea level humid climate. They realized that was also not appropriate for training Tibetan soldiers. And so they ended up moving the entire operation to Colorado, which is the state where I live, which has a high altitude training camp that had existed, that had been built in World War II for training ski paratroopers to fight against the Nazis in Europe, you know, basically in Italy and Austria. And so it was called Camp Hale, and its elevation is roughly, I think, around, I'll say around 11,000 feet. So up pretty high for the United States. It was the closest they could get in the continental US to approximating a Tibetan landscape, right? High elevation mountains. And it was somewhat isolated. And so they created a secret camp. This was in 1958, right? Where this earlier, this World War II training camp had been. So for 6 years, from 1958 through 1964, the CIA trained several hundred Tibetan soldiers there. Right. They also, however, got the Nepali government and the King of Mustang, the Lojebo, right, to agree to establish a Chushigandru camp in Mustang, Tibetan Lo, which is a small kingdom in Nepal that sticks up into Tibet. Right. So that was the military headquarters. The office headquarters was in Darjeeling. And Darjeeling and Kalimpong, these were the places where Tibetans could come out. Like the Natu La was there, so coming out of Tibet, that was the traditional trade route. So it was a place, these were Tibetan places where Tibetans from in Tibet had lived for a long time and knew well. All right. So we have the training camp in Colorado, we have the military camp in Nepal, we have the office, basically in Darjeeling, and then the Indian government initially agrees to create a Tibetan battalion. Unit 22, or Establishment 22, was formed. So this was kind of the Chushigandru, like, sibling, cousin-brother organization, right, in the Indian military, and then later the Special Frontier Force. So there are two Tibetan forces, one under the Ministry of Home and one under the Army. Histories of those also remain somewhat arrested, but that's a related but somewhat different story. So the training camp in Colorado ended in 1964. The military camp in Mustang in Nepal continued on for another decade after that, until we got to the point where Nixon and the United States, President Nixon, were normalizing relations with China. Things were changing. The Tibetans were not winning. What they were being successful at was collecting intelligence, from China. So the number one intelligence haul that the U.S. government had during the entire Cold War in relation to China was a leather satchel of documents that Chuxigandru's soldiers captured. Like the number one thing. Like all of the other CIA spies, nothing even added up to that. However, the operation just really wasn't accomplishing the sort of goals that it needed to accomplish, right? They were sort of being a gadfly or a thorn in the side of China. So that also Nepal was not incredibly happy having the army there. And so eventually it was shut down, again, not without controversy and death, actually. So the Nepali government tried to shut down the army, and the Tibetans had no interest in listening to the Nepalese. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama finally had to send an emissary who had a message from himself, from the Dalai Lama himself. And it was only upon hearing the message from the Dalai Lama, right, that the Tibetan soldiers agreed to finally, right, stop operations. However, even that wasn't enough. A number peacefully basically surrendered their weapons and went with the government of Nepal to be resettled in Nepal. Some very sadly committed suicide. Others tried to escape, and the Nepali army pursued them, and a number of Tibetans were killed. It's a very, very sad end to that particular chapter.
Yeah. So when you go back to your field work, right? So you're talking also about like Baba Lekshi, and you're also talking about lots of things like the memories and belongings. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more about what is the memories or what are the belongings and what is the missing in that between?
Yeah, so I used to call this research the project of many grandfathers, because when I started it, I was very young. I was 24 years old, I think, when I started this research. And I was spending all of my time with men between the ages of 60 and 90. So it was, you know, young Carol and all of these old men who saw me as like a daughter, granddaughter figure. And they were lovely, and they had so many stories to tell. And again, many of them hadn't told the stories to anyone. You know, to their families, to their friends. And in telling them, a lot came up, including borrowing from the anthropologist Veena Das, the phrase, the pains of belonging. So sometimes we think that the most painful element of a relationship is to not belong, right? To try to fit in, but you don't fit in. And instead, what I learned from these men, these veterans, was that often the greater pain is in the compromises you make, right, to belong. So these veterans basically had to give their consent to not tell their story, right, for their history to be arrested, to remain at the level of memory, right, something they knew but didn't speak of, or maybe just personal stories shared among friends. You know, like when you went for Clora at Boda, large, massive, right, Tibetan Buddhist a stupa, a temple of Chorten in Kathmandu that you walk around multiple times each day as a form of Kora or walking meditation. And sometimes you do that alone, praying while you do it with prayer beads. Other times you do it while you're walking with friends. And often when I was at Kora, I would come up and it would be, you know, three of the veterans walking together, right? You know, just kind of the, what does it mean to be in that space together where you know each other's stories? You don't have to say them, right? But you share memories, including the knowledge, right, that to everyone else you're just anonymous. You're not war veterans walking around, right? On June 16th, on the founding day of Chuxigandru, no one is feting you or celebrating you or commemorating, right, your actions or your sacrifices. So I was interested in, and again, it was the 90s, so this was very current in anthropology at the time, the relationship between history and memory, right? Why do we connect those two? How do they work together? In what way does memory maybe stand in for history when histories can't be told? And what's the shape and the form of memory in relationship to history? Also in terms of the truth claims and the status, right, that's given to these. So again, the men who were sharing their stories with me were very aware that the history was arrested, but the arrest of the history was also felt to them somewhat punitive, right, or something that was that there was an element of something negative, something bad associated with it, right? And so that they had to tread very carefully, right, in telling the story. Not trying to be unclear, there's so much, there was a lot of politics happening at the time. And many people had to work very carefully to try and navigate and negotiate, you know, their own relationship to things that were happening in 1994. A group of Chuxigandru veterans signed an agreement with the Mongolian and Tibetan Affairs Commission of Taiwan. They said they did it in the name of His Holiness to try and ease the way for him to return to Tibet should the ROC be the ones who end up being in charge of Tibet. His Holiness was not happy, you know, at all, and had not known in advance, you know, and this caused a great split among the veterans, right? So just these pains of community. When history is held in abeyance, when history is arrested, right, when things aren't known, what fills that space? Right? Absences are always filled, you know, with something. And often it's some form of fear.
The new commercial like the film, like Four Rivers and Six Rangers is coming very soon. And like recently, there are lots of other like documents, the books, and also coming. Like, do you think that like the arrested history of the Tibet is still under the arrest, or is like coming out? Is a time to do
this? Right. Yeah, my research, which is now 30 years ago, so 3 decades. You know, a long time. The soldiers, the veterans, felt that the time to tell the histories had come. And many of them overtly discussed that with me. You know, it's even in there, I think verbatim, the time for telling history has come. You know, someone said that to me. The time for telling the secrets has come. That said, I think we're still in the period of release. You know, it's not full. So let me give you a couple. So even before this book was published, there were other books. Andra Gompatashi published a book called Four Rivers, Six Rages before his death. So again, the leader. You know, so, and that book was published by the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives. Right? So that exists. However, it didn't give away too much because it couldn't at the time, right, when that book came out. There are a couple other books that focused on the CIA, right? There are little things here and there. Jungyun Norbu had written Warriors of Tibet, focused on Nyerung Aten's story. Nyerung Aten, again, is the one who told me I had to study history if I wanted to talk about culture and politics, right? So it wasn't that there were little things, right, coming out. Then my book came out, two other books came out focused on the CIA. Two CIA officers wrote books, Roger McCarthy and Ken Knaus, like from a CIA perspective. So there was a moment where it felt like lots was happening. Tenzin Sonam and Rito Seren made a film, right, Shadow Circus, a documentary film that interviewed many of the veterans. That came out in the, I want to say, 95 or so, kind of mid-90s. So there was a period, and let me pause by saying, Tenzin Sonam's father is Drongyik Lamosering, who was Drongyik's secretary to Jalutunden, right? So someone who himself had been involved in the resistance, and deeply involved, like front row seat. After I did my research, the next thing that really seemed to happen, because all of this that I'm talking about was all in English, all of a sudden a bunch of Tibetan language books started coming out. So Lamo Tsering's, I mean, multiple volumes. Ratu Ngawang, multiple volumes. Zhang Ritsang family, we have a book from them that I helped them edit that was originally in Tibetan, translated into English. Dewa Tsang, Anya Tsang just came out with a book. So lots of different families, right? People who collected, whether it was biography, autobiography, you know, family working together to produce the book. More and more have been coming out. A commercial film, you're right, like a fiction film is now being made based on the Dewa Tsang book. So, and I don't know if that's coming this year or next year, but an all Tibetan production. So super exciting. So things are happening. However, just telling the story, the existence of this book or the existence of a film isn't enough. So I want to give 3 examples of why not. So my book came out in 2010. It's been out for a while now. The day after I received it in the mail, I received it September 9th, 2010. And there's a page in this book that says, if you go to Camp Hale, which is now a National Historic Site, it talks about what happened in the camp up to 1958, and then the story picks up again from 1964. So for the 6 years that the Tibetans were there, it said nothing, like as if nothing had happened there. The day after my book was released, we had a ceremony at Camp Hale to install a plaque saying that from 1958 to 1964, the CIA trained Tibetan soldiers here. So my book was like, was out of date on the day it was published, basically. Right. However, who was at that ceremony? CIA veterans were there. Chushigandru veterans were there, the children of both of those groups, others from the local Tibetan community were there, some reporters from VOA and RFA were there, and I was there, right, the scholar. Who was not there? And Senator Mark Udall, so one of the two Colorado senators, so a major US politician was there. There was no one there from the Dalai Lama's government. So that absence, the fact that no one had come, not from Dharamsala, but from New York or from DC. That showed that the history in some ways was still arrested, right? The fact that there was no one there from the government. A couple years after this book came out, I was giving a talk about it at Harvard, and a young man came up to me and said, you know, Professor Carroll, I'm halfway through your book, and this is amazing, and I'm also a spoken word and hip-hop artist. He was a rapper. And he said, I want to make a rap song from this book. And so he did. His name's Olo. It's on YouTube, if you want to see. This is a while ago now. But he went beyond that. So there is a rap version. Like it's called Four Rivers, Six Ranges, like a Chushigandru rap that you can find that's phenomenal that he did. But then he went beyond that. And he organized what is, to my knowledge, the first ever June 16th program to an educational program, but also a commemorative program about Chushigandru for the Tibetan community that was not a Kampa program. Right? It was in Boston, and it was just for the Tibetan community there, where they said, we are going to bring the community together, it doesn't matter which region you're from, to learn about this history, right, and to honor, right, the people who participated in it. So there's the two things. The third thing is that the Tibetans, so most of the men who participated in this have now passed away, right? There's not very many of them left. But what they are most looking for and what they are starting to get, right? Any of us in this room, Tibetan or non-Tibetan, our appreciation matters, especially those of you in this room who are Tibetan, your appreciation, your acknowledgement of their story matters. But it's really about the relationship to His Holiness, right, to the Dalai Lama. And actually, I wanted the subtitle of this book to be Tibet, the Dalai Lama, and Memories of a Forgotten War. Instead, the subtitle is Tibet, the CIA, and Memories of a Forgotten War. And I said to my publisher, to my editor, I said, the Dalai Lama is more important than the CIA. And he said, well, Tibet and the Dalai Lama, in the world of publishing, kind of cancel each other, not cancel each other up, this is the same thing. And the CIA will draw people to the book in an important way. But really, this book is about the relationship people have to the Dalai Lama. And what it means to honor that relationship while hoping that something different is possible, right? That you can tell this story, not just tell this story before you die, but that you can perhaps die in a free Tibet, and that the work that you did toward that goal, right, counted and is acknowledged and is appreciated.
Nearly 13, 14 years after you published this book, United States support to the Tibetan government, especially for the progress of democracy, welfare, and all these things. The state and Western countries, their support for the CIA and Tibet wars, and then they moved shift to the non-violence and all these things. Now coming back to the Tibet through the like the state level implementing laws and all these things.
Yeah.
Like, what do you feel like the progress or?
I think U.S. assistance and support for Tibet is insufficient. And I'm not a British citizen, but I would say the same, you know, for the UK as well. the UK was one of the only countries in the world that had treaties and relationships with an independent Tibet, and they have not held up their end of the the relationship at all. But I will not only blame the British, I will also blame my own country, which has acted mostly in its own interests, which is basically what diplomacy is, trying to advocate for your own interest and meet somewhere in the middle. But the middle, there's only a middle when you have an adversary who is of equal status. So the United States does do some work, and there are many individuals, just ordinary people, activists, citizens, as well as elected politicians who truly work hard on behalf of Tibet. Now that there are many Tibetans resident in the United States as citizens, and not as many here in the UK, but also Tibetans who are citizens, right? With citizenship, then you can also advocate for yourself vis-a-vis elected officials, right? Or become an elected official yourself, which is something now we see. There are Tibetan elected officials in the United States, in Switzerland, and Canada, making a true difference from that position, right? Not just lobbying officials, but becoming, right, a government official. Some of the things that the United States has done that I think have been good. So, for example, the United States has put into law that the succession of the current Dalai Lama, that the next Dalai Lama, the process of finding and naming who that individual will be, is something that is in the power of only the Dalai Lama himself, right? That is something that goes to the Tibetan community, but specifically to the Dalai Lama. And why that is important is because geopolitically, China tries to claim that, right? That only, and the irony is large, only the Chinese Communist Party can name the next Buddhist reincarnation of the Dalai Lama. Again, farce. But to the PRC, very, very serious, and that's what they say to the world. Right. So the fact that the United States at least puts on paper statements like that, and yet standing up to China in a way that would truly enable what Tibetans need and want feels not fully possible in today's world.
Do you think all those information are in the public information now, or are they still? Do you think there's still some information that are?
So you can request documents through we call it a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act in the United States. However, when you request documents from the CIA, they come to you heavily redacted. And what that means, if I could just hold this one, is that you get the paper and you see everything is blacked out. So you can see that a sentence is there, but you can't see what it says. And I have an article coming out this year on redaction that centers on a story told to me by Ken Kanau. So he was one of the retired CIA officers who wrote a book. And he wrote a book called Orphans of the Cold War about Tibet. And because he was retired, he had to request his own files. Like formally, he had to put in a FOIA request for his own documents. And documents that he wrote, right? He is the one who had written the report or the letter, came to him redacted. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't even allowed to see his own records. So those records exist, but we don't have access to them. It's similar if you go to India, for example, many documents relating to Tibet are also not visible. Some of those same documents, if I go here to the India office library in the British Library, I can see them here. And then if I go to Delhi, I can't see the documents I looked at yesterday in London, I can't see tomorrow in Delhi, because they have anything related to the border. The border of India and Tibet is militarized, right, or closed to scholars. So the access to documents is something that's incredibly difficult. Tibetan documents, of course, are also hard to find. So any Tibetan government documents that, and those were left behind. Those weren't brought out into exile when they escaped. If they still exist, and weren't destroyed by the Chinese, I don't have access to those. Some scholars inside might, and there is some writing about Chushi Gandru by scholars inside Tibet. Outside, Shushigandru veterans collected battalion histories. So they have tons of written records, and for decades have talked about publishing those, but it's never happened. And I don't know the status, I'm sure someone does, I just at the moment don't know the status of all of those very painstakingly written, handwritten documents that different battalions kept about their members, battles they fought, you know, pay scale that the soldiers got, or, you know, the punishments meted out for various things. You know, it was a real army, right, with real rules and real regulations. And so those are, they were in Majdakatila for a long time. I don't know, between Majdakatila and Dharamsala, where all of the documents for Shushigandru themselves are kept at the moment. But that's also another source that exists.
And then, so can you talk more about your current project related to Tibet?
I have several going on. The further on you get in your career, the more you have projects kind of overlapping. I still remain a, you know, scholar of Shushigandru. So we just found the camp. So in 2010, when we had the ceremony there, again, there were both CIA veterans and Shushigandru veterans there, and they went off to see if they could find where the camp had actually been. So it's a very large site. And they couldn't pinpoint the exact location, which was a huge disappointment, right? So we were just at the site in general. At the time, the camp had had a big wall around it, and the access road was different than it currently is. So I think there was also, in addition to being, you know, 50 years later, there was also some disorientation in terms of the, you know, geographic location. We just found it last month. And so we're having a ceremony this summer on June 9th to mark the and commemorate the actual location. And the, our local, the Colorado Shushigandru, is hoping to get permission to build a stupa or a chorten on the site. But we have to work with the National Park Service to see if that's possible. The other projects I'm working on, I've been working for a long time now on citizenship, on refusal, on theoretical storytelling. So I'm finishing up a book on that right now. I also, for many decades, have been researching and writing about the Pongtsong family, so a Kampa trading family who in the span of one generation went from regionally important traders to the richest family in all of Tibet. However, then fell just as sharply as they had risen due to a fight that the patriarch had with Jalutundub, with the Dalai Lama's brother, so the same man who was involved in Shushigandru. And the family suffered what you could call a social death. And to this day, their story is one that also remains very difficult to tell. And perhaps even more controversial in some ways than a history of the CIA, you know, or of nonviolence, because it involves writing about someone's family, and think about just how intimate that is, right? Ethnography is intimate. Ethnography is much more intimate than history. You know, history can be, but ethnography is the face-to-face, bringing that into it, right? The sitting with stories, the rhythms of everyday life, knowing the cadence of someone's voice, knowing how they like to take their tea, in person, right? Not just through reading someone's diary or reading about them. And so for me, that book, I published 6 or 7 articles. So they're scattered about in different places, but there's something about collecting them in a book that's been a bit daunting. So I'm also working on a major volume called The Tibet Reader with a wonderful group with Dichen Pemba, who's based here in London, with Lama Jab, a professor up at Oxford, with Dondup Tashi Rekchung, who's finishing up his PhD at Northwestern in Buddhist Studies, and with Nicole Willick, who's a professor of Buddhist Studies in Virginia. And that is a major volume covering the early 20th century all the way up to the present, focused on culture, history, and politics in all primary sources.
Thank you so much, Professor Carol Sojourn, to TukTok Podcast. And all my friends, thank you for joining to TukTok Podcast. This is like my first live interview in English, but hopefully many things come. Thank you so much. Thank you.